So looking first at the black hole with its no-drama horizon, and the strong gravity and some drama occurs well within the black hole. But along with this no-drama horizon comes the information paradox. And there's some pretty basic questions about black holes, like where and what is the entropy of a black hole? So what is going on for a not-quite black hole is that the strong gravity region comes right out to extend just beyond where the horizon would be. So there is no horizon here, and that takes care of the information paradox. So this strong gravity region extends only slightly beyond, a very small distance beyond the would-be horizon of order of the Planck length. So beyond that, then you go into the Schwarzschild metric, and inside you rapidly deviate from the Schwarzschild into something completely different. And we've all seen this picture where we have to go off to minus infinity in tortoise coordinates in the black hole case. So the whole point about a not quite black hole is that the waves have a finite travel time to the origin of this object. And the origin acts like a reflecting point in the radial equation, and the waves just come back out. So that means that effectively there's a wall in this picture. And that wall plus the potential barrier gives us our cavity. I'm calling its size delta x. And the round trip travel time is just twice that. I'll be calling that delta t. And it's that simple because of tortoise coordinates. So tomorrow I'll be talking about what I'm doing with LIGO data, and I guess the question is, how did I, of all people, end up with looking at LIGO data? So we started at the beginning with quantum gravity and what to do about that. So we wanted to look at it from the point of view of a quantum field theory and try to bring some of the insights we have about QCD into this question. So actually, that wasn't that hard to do because there was this old proposal for a UV completion of gravity called quadratic gravity. So that was not hard to adapt to this picture. So one of the first things then was to reconsider this problem with this old theory, which was the ghost. And so what happens to the ghost in this more QCD-like version of the theory? So from QCD, over many years, to understand this theory, we had to face the fact that the naive perturbative states of QCD are quite different from the physical spectrum. So this naive ghost in quadratic gravity is just part of the naive perturbative spectrum. And if we're considering it in this version that looks more like QCD with a strong region that I'll get to in a sec, this naive ghost turns into this unstable gate, unstable state that has a slight acausality. And by slight, I mean something of order the Planck time. So that pretty well sums up the picture. And I guess then the question is, who's scared of a fake ghost? And anyway, so that was good enough for me to at least be able to say, well, there's some hope with this theory, so let's go on and see what it says about black holes, for example. And it does open up a whole new solution space. So we explored that solution space and studied these not quite black hole solutions, which are actually, it's in some sense, a more generic set of solutions than the black hole solutions. So quadratic gravity still has black holes, but they have this larger class with more parameters set of solutions.
Sorry, so you say that the naive ghost is non-programmatic if we move on to the non-parametric region.
Yeah. Just like the gluon is not a physical particle in that theory.
That's why you use QCD, like.
Yes. Okay, and then I guess we had a series of lucky breaks.
Sorry,
yeah.
Can I ask you a question? So are there any examples like in ordinary goal theory where you have something that has a ghost naively, but then in the infrared it doesn't?
Or is it? You can try to construct quantum gravity.
Gravity is weird, we don't understand how quantum gravity, but field theory we understand. So this example of something that looks like it's a ghost in the UV or in the naive theory, but then is that really a ghost? Is there an example of that?
Not for a ghost, but QCD has what I just said, that
yeah.
Gluons and quarks are not in the physical spectrum.
Right.
And as you say, we're not talking about a gluon, we're talking about a ghost. It's spin two massive particle. Well, in the version of quadratic gravity I'm looking at, it's the massless version, so.
But it could be a spin, I can ask about a spin zero or a spin one. That could be. If theory naively has ghosts of a spin zero and spin one, I would be just ordering a field theory then. But really, that's the difference.
Yeah, if you're talking about a weakly defined theory, then you have a problem.
Right.
It's in the spectrum. It's just in theories that we know that describe nature, that is not always the case. And it does have, in the end, that state that replaces it is still weird in some way. So that weirdness has carried over from the fact that the original thing was a ghost.
I guess I can think about, people have lattice QCD simulations. Would they add ghost gluons to this and see whether?
I think John Donahue is trying to get that done. Like he thinks that's a good way to probe the theories on a lattice.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll say more about these solutions, but it was around the time that Cardoso and Pani were pointing out the connection between echoes and echoes. ECOs are their name for exotic compact objects. And so we saw that our solutions were natural echoes, and with a time delay that was roughly predicted. So the next lucky break is that LIGO was releasing public data. So we joined Niash and his group and other outsiders looking for echoes, and we developed our own strategy. And it also helped that we had this rough prediction, because I think we ended up looking over a wider range of time delays than some of the other searches. But so I'm just trying to say that it's good to have some theory, because theory points you in directions you may not consider. And then the third lucky break is LIGO didn't completely take over the game. At the very beginning, I was paranoid, because I thought as soon as we said anything, they would just jump in and finish the whole thing off. But that was clearly wrong. And I guess we could say it's a lucky break for everyone here, because we can just sit back and take our time and figure out what we're doing. And that's what I'm doing. I'm still in the process of figuring out what I'm doing. Tomorrow I'll be talking about these signals that I think I'm seeing, and recently have got these p-values for all 10 events. So I'll show that tomorrow. And collaborators, some of you know these people. Jing Ren was even here for a while. So she got involved at the very beginning. And my student Randy has been involved with the echoes. But as far as the search goes, I'm the one doing that. So let's just say a little bit about the theory, but I'll just stick from a very big picture point of view. And so here's a very big picture question. How does nature generate a mass scale? So the only known way, or at least the only way that's known for sure to occur in nature, is the QCD way. QCD is a UV complete theory by itself. It's asymptotically free. And its coupling then grows strong into the infrared. And where it grows strong, that defines the mass scale. And that defines the whole scale of the whole spectrum. And then below that scale, we have a theory of pions. And at low energies, that's a weak theory as well. So QCD is a weak theory both in the UV and the IR. And it's just a narrow band where we have to worry about strong interactions. So then that was our initial question. Can the same thing work for the Planck mass? And this is where quadratic gravity comes in, because it was well known from long ago that it's it has a coupling, which is asymptotically free. It's a renormalizable theory. So just an ordinary quantum field theory in that sense. So then in the same way, it also defines a mass scale. And then we can say, could it be that the Planck mass comes from that? So the Planck mass here is not something you put into the action in terms of the Einstein term. It comes out.
So in the previous picture that we had two quantum mechanics, and Einstein gravity is not quite quantum. Is that where the analogy breaks down?
No, Einstein's theory is well treated as a quantum field theory in exactly the same way. It's a non-renormalizable quantum field theory. And John Donahue, I've already mentioned, is well known for developing that field. Yes.
It's quantum, but it has a cutoff, so you cannot see beyond that cutoff.
So let me just add a little more detail to the picture. So the version of quadratic gravity I'm considering is the one without the Einstein term. And this version then has a classical scale invariance and two terms, but the Weyl square term has this coupling, which is asymptotically free. The Weyl square term is also the one that's crucial for these solutions I'm talking about. The R squared, the other term, we can take it or leave it. Okay, so just like in QCD, we're assuming there's a mass being generated, a mass scale being generated. And at the same time, this dynamics does not break the gauge symmetry, which in this case is the diff invariance. So those are the two properties then that determine what the low energy theory is. We know the symmetries, we know there's a mass scale. So that then allows the Einstein term to show up. Plus the whole set of higher curvature terms. But again, at low energies, it's the Einstein term that dominates. So that's exactly the same as in the pion theory, where in that case, there's an f pi squared two derivative term. That's the term that dominates at low energies. Okay, and then I am saying that it's possible that there are no black holes in nature. There are all these, instead, not quite black holes. And to even have that possibility relies on having a UV complete theory. Because I showed you that picture of a not quite black hole. And on the outside, it's low curvature determined by the Einstein term. On the inside, it's high curvature determined by the quadratic terms. So the interior structure then is probing the UV completion. If we didn't have any UV completion, we wouldn't have any of this. Okay, so I've been talking about a quantum theory, which I think this is a theory to at least consider as a quantum theory of gravity. But to study these solutions, that we then moved on to a classical approximation of that theory. And this approximation is then more like a standard quadratic gravity theory where you have the Einstein term. It's just that this classical theory has the same high and low curvature limits as the quantum theory. So for high curvatures, these terms will dominate. At low curvatures, the Einstein term will dominate, just like in the quantum theory.
But I mean, usually you have a number of division in this field.
Yeah, that's right. But as in the picture of the solution, I think we're doing a good job of describing most of it. And as you say, there's some radial transition region, which we may not be doing a good job. So yeah, we have to account, or at least accept that unknown.
Okay, Right. I mean, it seems that maybe like similar to the membrane paradigm, maybe that's what you want to have. Like you want to have a membrane that connects those two.
Well, the classical theory does its own job of interpolating between those two regions.
Right, it's, but that doesn't, I mean, the coupling constant will diverge. They're not running, I mean, it's just they're constant.
That's right, and I take these, this one I don't care about. This one I take to be of order one, just to model the fact that the original theory does have strong interactions.
What order one? In what units?
Well, that's dimensionless.
It is.
Yeah.
Alpha and beta are right? Yeah. Alpha and beta are whatever.
Yeah.
But I think it's a different thing. I mean, you may argue that two things have the right limits, but then what they're actually, if you just connect them by a straight line, even though there is a singularity somewhere in between, that's not a fair interpretation.
Well, we'll look at the solutions and we'll see how crazy it is at that would-be horizon. So going to a metric in terms of these A and B functions. So the first thing we find is that at the origin, these A and B functions both go like R squared. So that's what led to us calling these things two-two holes. So if A and B goes like R squared at the origin, then the whole metric is going like R squared. So there's a zero of the metric, and that does lead to a naked time-like singularity. So that's something we have to learn how to deal with. As we'll see, the various things that we do want to calculate involve integrals. And the integrals that we do end up calculating are all finite. So in that sense, that singularity does not bother those things. Another thing we were interested in is the wave equation. And there again, we can end up calling the wave equation non-singular. So let me just explain that. So going back to the scalar wave equation, but in the original coordinates now, B over A is the square of the effective speed of light in that coordinate system. So these first two terms are quite similar to flat space. It's just the last term which deviates a lot because B is going like R squared, so that actually kills the what would be the standard centrifugal barrier term, which blows up at r equals 0. So that's the main difference. So all waves behave like L equals 0 waves, where that term is not there anyway. So other than that, it's much like the flat space radial equation for waves. And in particular, there are two solutions, two different behaviors near the origin, and only one of them makes physical sense. The other one has infinite energy in a finite volume. So in that sense, then the singularity doesn't introduce any ambiguity or some kind of ill-defined time evolution. So that's why these things, in this case, the wave equation can be called non-singular. Sometimes in other backgrounds with other singularities, these things are not true, and you do get several allowed solutions, which would mean an ambiguity. And then it does then lead to a well-defined boundary condition at the origin.
Sorry, yeah. Shouldn't you have higher derivatives, desired derivatives theory?
No, this is just the scalar wave equation.
Okay,
If you're looking at short wavelengths, if you're looking at long wavelengths, then the Einstein action would be what you use.
But of course, as you approach the center, then you go to the high curvature regime, and you wonder whether those.
Well, here you're going into very high curvatures too, but that doesn't show up in this wave equation.
But here, because the wave equation is second order wave equation, just changing the background.
Yeah, but it's a very high curvature background.
Right. And your argument, I think, is well taken. You're saying that these are, even though A and B are singular assumptions for the inverse divergence, the wave equation is not defined. But still, this is not the one that you want to solve for gravitational waves. But the one that you want to solve is the one that comes from wide gravity, that's higher derivatives. So I think that some argument is to be made that why those higher derivative terms are not heuristics.
Well, we've seen the in the Schwarzschild case what the wave equation looks like.
For the wide gravity?
No, for normal gravity.
Right.
And so so in that sense, that's based on the Einstein term.
Right.
And in that case, I think this kind of thing will still occur. So it's only for very small wavelengths that then you have to look at the higher.
I mean, it seems that it's a little bit inconsistent because you're saying your background is dominated by the quadratic term, that's what teaches the stars. But you said the perturbations on top of that background don't care about the quadratic term.
No, but it's no, he's saying independent of the wavelength. So if you have a LIGO kind of wavelengths, they would have.
But then they would probably lose it as they approach inside the. Inside this high curvature region.
Oh yes, inside there would be different. That's what you observe outside.
You want to trace waves going inside and coming out. Right? That's what the purpose of this is.
But in the tortoise coordinate system, it's actually a large cavity, and
right.
So we're talking about waves that have just a few nodes in that huge cavity.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, long wavelengths.
Okay, so now what you did is that just adding the canonical. Scale of it into the original Lagrangian, and then the scale of it just forms the equation.
Yeah.
So now if we want to look into the Gaussian waves, real Gaussian waves, yeah, as Jens said, so we should consider the perturbation of the quadratic gravitational series, then it drives the wave equation of it.
Yes.
It sounds very, challenging. But
we're going to go push this a little further because we're going to see, actually, going back to the potential way, the tortoise version of this equation where you have a potential, we can now see what that potential looks like in this background. So that'll tell us something. But let me just keep going with this analogy with QCD because... I've been talking about what I'm calling two-two holes, and these things have no upper limit on their size. So they're much like black holes in that sense. But if you push it down to very small size, Planck scale, then there is a lower limit on the size. And so we've been studying this type of thing more recently, and it's actually a dark matter candidate. And yeah, the structures of these two things on the interior are very different. And for these guys, there's a scaling relation. As you scale the size, the interior solution just scales in a nice way.
Sorry, you also had some sort of shell of matter somewhere in these two holes?
Yes. Yep. But I just want to connect to QCD again, because in this case, we're all familiar with the hadrons of QCD. Those are fixed size solutions of order the size of the theory. Less well known are these possible quark matter states, and these are variable size that can go all the way up to neutron star size, after which they would turn into a black hole. So in both cases, you have a theory with a fundamental scale, both arising in the same way. And I'm saying in both cases, there are these solutions which are effectively strongly interacting over a macroscopically large region. But they're there. And so that idea of having these large solutions, even though they're involving that small scale that tells you what the curvatures are doing all above the Planck mass. So that is a little non-intuitive, I think. It's hard for people to accept, but I'm just saying in QCD, the same thing happens. In the QCD case, the chiral condensate is getting suppressed in the interior because of the dense quark gas. In the gravity case, with the dense matter, it's actually the volume element that is being pushed smaller. Okay, so yeah, I'll get into these solutions a little more. As I said, the vial square term is the essential term. And as you're remembering, Jing and I first looked at this with a thin shell. But then later I found solutions that are sourced by a relativistic gas. So these are more interesting solutions. And there's a local temperature then, inversely proportional to this B function in the metric. And that's just hydrostatic equilibrium. Okay, so now we have a gas, a normal gas. If it's an ideal gas like this, that doesn't even have viscosity. So it gets back to this question of what's going on in quantum gravity. And so we can calculate the entropy because the gas has normal entropy. And this is one of these calculations that turns out to be finite, even though there's a singular behavior. So the entropy is well defined and easy to calculate. And in the end, we get an area law. No, it's a little bigger. So I think, yeah, everything here is quite clear. It's like a star-like object, and we're used to thinking about these things, and there's no paradox or anything else like that, right? And yet, we are getting these connections between thermodynamics and geometry, and also the particle content of the universe, because everything gets excited inside these things, because the temperature is eventually blowing up. And so the entropy then is going to be related to what the particle content of the universe is. So it's all clear here, right? Whereas in a black hole, somehow the entropy doesn't depend on the particle content of the universe.
Do you assume Hawking temperature?
Well, no, let's just see what happens. Whoops. What happened? Yeah. So we solve the field equations, and that gives us A and B, and a particular combination of these quantities. So T infinity, which is what would be the temperature of this gas if it extended all the way out to infinity. So in that sense, it's not really a Hawking temperature. It's just a temperature. And a combination with the species number and this coupling alpha. So then everything is determined. And this T at infinity is up to this constant, the Hawking temperature. And this the entropy is this integral. And it doesn't blow. The integrand is finite at the origin. And so we get a finite result, which goes like the area. Well, you can say, well, how in the world did the area come out of that? Well, that's related to how A and the B that's in the T, those things scale. As I mentioned, there's a scaling solution. So the larger the mass or the radius is, the size of A and B are scaling in a certain way. And that scaling is what gives this area law.
Sorry, how did you get the first equation?
It just, you put the source into the field equations, the relativistic gas. It's characterized by T infinity. And the equations just determine that combination of things.
The
quadratic gravity field equations with a relativistic source.
It's all static.
It's all statics, yeah. No.
Isn't that it's like the density at infinity that's really constrained, right? So that's what you're constrained.
Yeah, T infinity characterizes the matter.
It's n times, yeah, n infinity times n infinity to the fourth power. That's the thing that's, I guess, fixed by the mass of the black hole.
Yes, right? Yes. It's related to the mass through the equations. These equations are pretty ugly in quadratic gravity, and that's why these solutions have not really been looked at. you have to just deal with the mess. Okay, and then the other thing is this constant here, it's going like n to the 1/4. For the standard model, that number is then larger than 1. So these two holes can have entropy larger than the same size black hole. And that means that that could be one reason why collapse to two holes are favored over collapse to black holes. Just a simple entropy argument.
Usually, if we have a higher curvature theories in GR, then entropy is calculated by the definite theorem by Ward. So,
you're talking about black holes?
Yes. Usually, in the gravity theory, if you have a higher curvature terms,
yeah,
as theorem,
yeah,
as
yeah,
terms,
yeah,
then entropy should be calculated by the formula in the chart. So how?
Yeah, but aren't you talking about a black hole with a horizon? Yeah, but I'm not talking about those solutions here. I did mention that those solutions still exist in this theory, and that's why I'm comparing those solutions to these new solutions, which don't have a horizon. So you don't calculate entropy based on some horizon. It's simpler. You just got a gas, so you just calculate the entropy of the gas.
So you don't have any horizon?
No.
So that 1.33 is exactly the inverse of 0.75.
Yes, it turns out this product is the black hole result.
Okay, so the product is in fact what you get from GR.
Yes.
So sometimes this is what you expect. Because the product is what comes from the classical GR, but the temperature comes from a quantum theory around the horizon. But since you don't have a horizon, then there is no reason to get talking temperatures.
Correct.
So.
So this is, I guess, a GR. Okay, I'll try to speed up a bit. So if you're interested in what these A and B functions look like, this is a case where the horizon, would be horizon size, is 80 in Planck units. And you can see outside, that's the Schwarzschild behavior. Inside, it completely changes. The ratio of B over A, though, is finite everywhere, and it's a finite speed of light everywhere, less than 1. It actually gets smallest right around RH.
So there's nothing going up at RH? It looks like something goes up and down.
Yeah, well, that's B over A is getting very small there.
But it's not zero or it's small?
Just small. It's finite. It's non-zero. So as you say, something looks like it's spiky right there. But if you look at the curvatures around RH, at least on this linear scale, nothing fancy is happening there. You only see something fancy if you look at a log plot here. Then you can see a kind of a step in the curvatures happening. But the curvatures themselves don't get very large until somewhat inside. So, but then going back to this question, where is this transition region where quantum gravity might play a role? Well, it's hard to even know where that occurs. Does it occur in here somewhere? I don't know. But it doesn't go along with that more striking behavior in A and B.
You can compute where it's your quadratic tensor compared with the Einstein there.
Right, yeah.
That would be
some point inside, yeah.
So that's spiky behavior. Is it actually smooth if you look at it?
Yes. It's a spike that goes up and comes back down.
So it's not pointy like this, but
as you make this thing larger and larger, it gets more and more pointy. Yeah.
So these are just solutions to quadratic gravity with radiation, basically.
Yes. Okay, so this will now get to this other question that was being raised. If we compare this 2-2 hole to these other things, a truncated black hole, you just put a wall. A very compact star, you see the centrifugal barrier, we said doesn't exist for the 2-2 hole. But the 2-2 hole does have a little structure here, and this little structure actually corresponds to the interior of the 2-2 hole. So all that crazy A and B dependence just boils down to a little change in this potential in the wave equation. And most of the distance here is coming from that region where the spike is occurring. So that gives you a large tortoise coordinate. In fact, more realistic is instead of around 80, it should be around 400. That's the more typical size of the cavity. So we do make a big deal out of this simple wave equation and looking at that result and then saying, well, the truncated black hole looks like as good an approximation as we can get. And in the case when there's spin, we don't have any two-two hole with spin. So we have to just go to the Kerr black hole, truncate it, and use that approximation. And just neglect any little structure like that. Yeah, so we all know about the cavity structure and how it produces echoes. But how do we know that that's actually the case when one of these things first forms? How do we know that initial perturbation is just going to give that simple pulse that goes back and forth? And that's what gives you an echo. If you don't have that, it could be a more complicated perturbation, then you may not even get echoes. But we are talking about a 1D cavity, and along with that comes an evenly spaced resonance spectrum. And that's more general than echoes. And that's what I'm saying LIGO should have been thinking about. When we listen to musical instruments, we're listening to the spectrum. We're not just listening for echoes, right? So.
This is what we first call this ecology and then decide to call this seismology.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is something else we can talk about because we're getting slightly different results in these how these echoes look. And I'm finding echoes that are actually quite complicated looking. So I've taken out the time between the echoes, and you see each one is quite different from the others. And if this was true, then of course it makes it even more difficult to look for echoes directly in the data. We'll get back to where that came from. But there is this one LIGO echo search, and I think it's kind of clear there's no hope they're going to see anything the way they've done it. Because they said, well, let's try to model these echoes by what they call generalized sign Gaussians. And this is an example. To parameterize that is 9 parameters. And so, of course, this is not going to overlap with what I just showed you. And then they'll say, okay, we can just use a superposition of these things. So some number n. And then you're ending up with some 9n parameters and the sensitivity goes down drastically. So there's really no hope.
Do you know what n is in there?
They don't even mention what n is.
Yeah.
I think they briefly say they somehow allow it to adapt in some way.
Yeah, I want to get that.
They don't tell you.
Somewhere it says 5, but
oh, that's the number. That's the number of echoes, I think.
Biggest number. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
In an earlier paper, they're a little more definite about n, but in the later paper, they don't say what it is. Okay. Well, this is my last slide. So these three plots on the left here are for different numbers of echoes, much bigger than 5. So for 50 echoes, you can still see the echoes, but eventually they start to merge. And with even more echoes, then they've mostly merged. Now I just add some Gaussian noise on top. And then you say, well, yeah, if we go longer and longer in numbers of echoes, it's going to get worse and worse because relative to noise, it's smaller and smaller. But let's look at the Fourier transform and the absolute value of both signal plus noise. Well, around 150 echoes, we do see something peeking up above the noise. And that is the evenly spaced resonance spectrum that I'm talking about. And so next time I'll say more about where that is coming from. But in the real data, we don't see things like that by the naked eye. So whatever echo structure like this there is, it's smaller than this, or smaller than this. So we have to do a better job trying to pick out that kind of structure when these spikes are not any higher than the noise level.
This was the assumption of a black hole created by two emerging black holes, and then looking for the echoes.
I'm talking about a not quite black hole being formed.
Yes. Ego is merging and forming one ego.
Yes. Yeah. So it's just formed in some state, in some perturbed state, and
it starts with a very large perturbation at an instant in China. Like
yes.
A bell with
yes.
Hammer.
Right.
So if a black hole, something else, forms in the supernova, it performs slightly differently, and it would agree matter, and then it would be more like a lot of noise hitting it, but for a long time.
So that could also excite
moles, but we would rather get resonant moles and then not things being at one hammer. So maybe that would lead to a different spectrum.
Well, if you're talking about larger black holes, supermassive ones, then the time scales we're talking about can be, I don't know, months or years. The time delay can be that large. Has anyone thought about these things?
I have a plot. Maybe you are. But yeah, that's an excellent question that for like for massive black holes, what sort of black holes
Yeah, we can talk more about that because they do see some periodic structures on long time scales.
For
not quite as supermassive, because that's even too long to even maybe look, but for something where the time scale is more in the 9 hour range.
Which object are you talking about?
Well, they call it an intermediate size black hole. So something with a delta T of 9 hours.
But is that observed? I mean, those are controversial.
Well, I can show you a Nature article where you see a nice plot with about five spikes that looks like our echo plots.
So I think the problem with exciting with the migration is that the masses of migration disks are always very small.
Yeah, this would have to be some big thing dropping in.
Right. So it must be something temporarily exciting, but then it should happen recently. Right?
So
something big that comes in.
So looking for a merger again.
Yeah, it's a merger, but maybe not the masses don't have to be that equal. So some kind of smaller black hole drops into a big one.
Are you looking for 10 to 1 or 1,000 to 1 or what mass ratio?
I have no idea, but it has to be big enough. Like we were saying, it can't be too small or the echo amplitude is going to be too small. So I would say that these echoes are coming out and they disturb the accretion disk. And that's the signal we're seeing. So as the echo passes through the accretion disk, then some of the accretion disk falls in and that's what we see.
One of the hopes that one may have is that these resonance structures, if they are some of them decay very, very slowly, then they could be excited over time. Because basically, you have a cavity with some harmonics. If they decay quickly, then you don't have much hope because then you need something very massive to excite it. Generic, that doesn't happen very often. But one possibility is that if you have a very long mode, then that could be excited at a stochastic over time, and that could give you something maybe. But that requires having very long modes.
Right.
What you say the decay rate?
It's model dependent, right?
Yes. This is an example of the very slow decay rate. And tomorrow I'll be looking in the data for things like this.
Yeah, so this is a model dependent, but the model is already here, the correct gravity.
That's like, well, not everything. I guess we were just discussing, we haven't even solved the right question. But I mean, the viscosity, I think, is one question is, you haven't really done anything with viscosity yet. I mean, you have a photon gas and it still doesn't have viscosity.
It has some higher order or second order effect, if it's not ideal. Ideal gas doesn't have viscosity.
But have ideal gas.
Yeah.
No, but it can be close. And
actually, I don't think it can. I mean, there is this limit, which is not a hard limit, but there's a minimum viscosity. Actually, if you have a thermal gas, it will have a minimum viscosity.
It should be bigger than something like entropy.
I think it's more of a conjecture, but I think it's, I think most cases it's been. You may violate it or mildly violate it, and the viscosity is always bigger than an entropy. So if you think this is a thermal gas, probably it should have some viscosity. I mean, some sense of fluctuations.
But in the limit, it was not interacting. If the non-interacting gas, then what happens?
But you see, it cannot have a thermal system which is not interacting. So, I mean, you could put the system just in a thermal state by hand, but if you want to think of a thermal state as something that naturally happens through that processes, then there should be some interactions that lead to that.
Yeah, but there's a limit where the interaction is weak.
Right.
So wouldn't the entropy, I mean the viscosity, have some weak limit?
Well, it depends on, one may think so, but there it is. These conjectures on viscosity, eta over S limits, which is we can talk about that. So, but those are all open questions. The other thing you haven't talked about the spin here, which is that teacher algorithm stability. So that would actually can give you growth unless you put some dissipation.
Yes. So this is assuming a small dissipation. Otherwise, as you say. Eventually, this will start blowing up. So there is a small dissipation going on here.
Right. So then, in fact, one can imagine scenarios that whatever dissipation you have could balance very finely with the growth, and then you can have very long lived models. And if you're lucky in that those, at least in some situations, arise, then they may even be excited around for massive.
Yeah. And this is for a particular spin of 2/3, but the same dissipation for something like higher 0.9 spin, that you would have an instability. But is that necessarily bad? I mean, we see lots of things blowing up in the universe that we don't know much about. So this kind of instability may be of interest.
There is argument that if it is instability that too violent, then you would have seen a spinning black hole. And there is evidence for a spinning black hole, at least from some astrophysical observations, but also. There is this argument that you would see too much of stochastic gravitational waves if all the spinning black holes were the spin down this way. So there's bounds from the stochastic gravitational wave black holes.
Well, I'm saying spinning down just to this spin of 2/3, for example.
Right. I think it could be some maximum spin, which is not fun.
On limit.
Yeah, there could be some maximum spin. So I think the astrophysical arguments is that we see some black holes that high spin. I think there is one with maybe
0.998.
Is that no? That's an observation observed one, or is that a
theoretical argument by Sol?
Right, there's a theoretical argument, but of course that's in relativity.
Yeah.
The question of observation is what is the maximum spin that you see, and I think that's. There is one with 0.99, which you may take it, or maybe there's some. There are questions about this astrophysical observation, and maybe you don't
interpret it correctly.
But yeah, so that would be there is one limit, but there's other argument says that if you form black holes in the universe, and typically you form with some spin, if they are all unstable, at least at the spin that they are formed, then you would they would emit a stochastic gravitational wave, so you would see this huge background of a stochastic gravitational. That would put a limit on how violent
this instability is, right? Because
so it could be that instability is only for typical spin of black holes that we form in the universe, and instability is not there, but maybe for higher spin there is. So I don't know where that limit will be, but probably I'm guessing it's quantum dependent. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that would be true even if the it's producing a burst, not just a continuous radiation.
Right, that's right. Because of course, there are a lot of black holes forming all over the place, so even if it's just bursts that you get out over time.
Yeah, but we do see a lot of bursts of things. These radio bursts,
right.
yeah.
Oh. Yeah, but this would be based on gravitational waves, I'm saying. So, there could be bursts of radio waves and not, but these would be based on gravitational waves. And if they take away a significant fraction of the mass of newly formed black holes, then that would be our limit for that.
These are newly formed, you mean at the beginning of the universe? Or?
No, I mean just throughout the astrophysical black holes that we formed through basically supernovae. Whatever ways that we think the black holes form. If a significant fraction of them go to gravitational waves, because of the stability, they're not violated.
But were they assuming complete no dissipation at all then, in that case?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So they were assuming there's no dissipation.
Right.
If there's some dissipation or dissipation will kick in, it would be a spin dependent, and they could be made out.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's thank Bob again.